Next case this morning is TBF Financial versus Boris Petrenko.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
It's a police escort. My name is Andreas Kisho. I'm appearing on behalf of both appellants, Petrenko and Bogolyubov.
Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I want to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
And we have several issues before us, and I'm going to address them in turn and emphasize my main points. We already did extensive briefing. First issue is capacity to sue. It is the position of both appellants that trial court abuses discretion when it allowed TBF to maintain suit in our state.
What is the fictitious name you claim TBF is doing business under?
My understanding, trade name is when you're doing business. The plaintiff is
so
conducting...
If I open up a store that says Judge Leach's Grocery, I'm doing business under a trade name?
But under definition of RCW, it says every person who does the name an LLC, which says TBF LLC, falls under this definition. I'll tell you which statute it is.
That's okay.
It's
you can go on with
1980-005. So the statute is clear, and it's our position that despite responding clearly, they're not doing business under trade name. They are. And they need to register it before they claim the lawsuit here. Next, Your Honor, is next issue is constitutional right to trial. Washington State Constitution guarantees the right to jury trial. And in our case, all our counterclaims were dismissed without any explanation. There were contractual counterclaims and were tort counterclaims and tort.
Well, wasn't the court enforcing the contractual provision that required that those claims be asserted against the original contracting party rather than an assignee of the contracting party?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is that unconstitutional to enforce that provision of the contract?
Your Honor, my clients dispute that they ever got the second page of the contract. The contract itself is disputed.
Well, you know, that raises an interesting question because the front page of the contract has in bold black letters language that says the terms and conditions printed on the reverse side are made a part hereof, suggesting it's a single piece of paper, and if you looked on the back side and it was blank, you would know something was wrong.
Correct, Your Honor, but what my client told me...
What's your answer to that?
That this contract was faxed to them from Konica Minolta.
Okay. Wouldn't that suggest to you some kind of inquiry, though, that there are more terms and conditions intended to be part of this contract since this is on the front page that was faxed?
It would suggest it to me.
Okay. And don't we generally charge parties with notice of contracts they sign even if they don't read the whole contract?
They do.
Why wouldn't we do that here?
I believe my clients, they told me they never got the second page.
I'm not questioning the veracity of your clients, but they made the decision then to go ahead and sign this without getting the second page. Why isn't that just like not reading the contract?
I don't know how to answer this question at this point, Your Honor.
But you go on to the rest of your argument.
Yes. But also, that argument, Your Honor, would go against public policy because what TBF is merely saying here, we're just here to collect, we're merely financing entity, but with equipment, go to somewhere else. Do the assignees step in the shoes of the person they got the contract from originally? So if you're merely financial entity, you just answer to all to our claims, but you're not responsible for any defects in equipment. And it is one of our arguments, Your Honor. And in fact, subsequently, after the summary judgment hearing, the settlement was reached for the first lawsuit, for the for the first lease, for the first lease. And the residual value was accepted. It was settled. So if they're claiming just financial rights, why are we talking about the equipment itself?
Why do we get to consider the context and substance of a settlement in terms of the second claim?
I'm not sure, but I can answer this because the first claim, Mr. Bogolyubov, he was only liable for the first claim, not for a second, and he settled first claim. Mr. Pachenko was not settling the first claim. It was two leases.
I understand that, and if the paralegal decided to settle the first claim, why does that inform our decision with respect to what the court decided on the second claim?
It doesn't. It wasn't my argument, Your Honor. My argument was the residual value for the first claim, for the first lease, was settled. So that suggests that the TBF is not merely a financial entity. They had some interest in equipment. Why not answer to counterclaims for the defective equipment and in torts for personal injury? Next, Your Honor, next time is summary judgment. It is our position that the plaintiff did not meet the burden. The standard is very high, and when a legal duty depends on proof of certain facts which may be disputed, summary judgment isn't appropriate. I understand what you previously said about the contract have a legal significance. So, I mean, it's the second page is presumed to be there.
Professor, can I ask you a question? There's an issue in the briefs about whether there was an oral modification of the contract.
Correct.
And assuming that an oral modification is available, what's the effect on the judgment here? The modification you allege is the lease term was shorter, which I assume would mean
from 60 months to 40.
The debt would be shorter. The debt would be smaller.
Put another way, did the court give summary judgment for the full term of the original lease or for lease payments for a shorter period of time?
Correct. According to my clients, Your Honor, because of defects with equipment, that non-conformity equipment was delivered.
Okay, we're almost out of time, so I don't want the whole history.
I understand.
Is the judgment for the full term of the original lease or for the term that your client argued was negotiated orally?
For original lease. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Zach Davies. I'm counsel for the respondent, TBF Financial LLC. Today I'd like to touch on a few points. First, I'd like to discuss the execution of the copier leases at issue. Certainly. TBF did not bring suit under a trade name. It does not use a trade name. It brought suit under its legal name, which is TBF Financial LLC. It is a foreign LLC.
I'm sorry, the statute doesn't make that distinction. The statute says, here's what trade names are, and it includes anybody doing business as an LLC. Now, I don't blame you for taking that case. I would have assumed the same thing, but I don't think the statute permits it.
Well,
so,
in the case
of Washington LLC, in which case they may have at the same time as registered or incorporating or become or have registered their trade name. That isn't necessarily the case with regard to a foreign corporation or a foreign LLC.
Well, in the case of a foreign LLC, which is normally required to register with the Secretary of State, that's not the case here, because under RCW 25.15.350, a foreign LLC is not required to register if it is simply collecting debts, and that's what TBF Financial LLC does. It's a debt collector. So
what statute is that?
That's RCW 25.15.350, subsection 1H. So because it wasn't required to register, the application of the trade name statute doesn't really apply, because they would have to be using a name that was other than what they had registered with the Secretary of State. Since they weren't required to do that,
So you're arguing there's a specific statute that addresses this issue that controls over the general?
Correct.
All right. Could you address the oral modification issue, why the defendants did not raise an issue of fact with respect to whether or not there was an oral modification of this, of these two contracts with Mr. Petrenko's declaration?
Certainly. The claim of an oral modification is meritless because the leases expressly state, and as you pointed out, the parties, the contracting parties, had a responsibility to read the entire contract, notwithstanding their claim of never seeing page 2. But you'll see on page 2, and this is Clerk's Paper 20, that there is
a... I'm familiar with paragraph 14, but we have Washington case law that says even a contract that says it can only be modified by a written modification signed by the parties can be orally modified.
Okay.
And the trial court doesn't appear to have been presented with that case law or address that question. Perhaps you could right now.
Well, Your Honor, I'm afraid to report that I'm not familiar with that case law. I know it was not argued below, and it was not argued in the appellant's brief, so I did not have a chance to actually look at that issue. I would argue now that by not arguing that particular point to the trial court, that the appellants waived that argument because the trial court did not have a chance to fully consider it and rule on it.
Trial court was presented with the issue that there was an oral modification, correct?
Correct.
And it was presented with evidence to support that contention. And so it would be your position, by failing to cite a particular case to the trial court, the appellants lost the right to appeal that issue?
Well, I would say that because it was mentioned basically in passing and was not fully briefed, I would say that's the equivalent of not presenting the issue to the trial court, because if the cases are not presented and TBF doesn't have a chance to respond with counter authority, how can the trial court really have a fair opportunity to rule on the issue?
I thought there was a declaration from Mr. Petrenko describing the changes that were agreed to.
Well, yes, he does claim that there was some conversations with the ConocoMinolta rep, but as far as briefing the actual legal issue...
confirm that conversation in his declaration as well? Mr. Petrenko says he was on another phone part of the conversation.
I'm not sure about that. I think there was a declaration by one Quinton Mitchum who said that he was listening, and he basically overheard Mr. Petrenko's side of the conversation. But if I could move on to the award of the fees and the costs that were included in the supplemental judgment of May 24th, 2011. It's also TBS position that this argument is waived on appeal because it was not timely raised with the trial court. When TBF moved for the fee award, the appellants did not argue against the reasonableness of the fees or the costs in their opposition brief. They waited until the morning of the hearing, which was May 24th. It was without oral argument, so it's not clear exactly what time the trial judge actually ruled on it and signed the judgment. But the local rule requires that any reply brief, which incidentally they're not entitled to because they're a non-moving party, but I think they went forward thinking that they also were entitled to a reply brief under that rule. But anyway, that reply briefs by the moving party are due by noon the day ahead of the hearing, not noon the day of the hearing. So what the appellants did was they filed their, quote, supplemental reply, unquote, at 10:11 a.m. And we believe that the trial court very well may have already signed the judgment and entered it by that point. All we have is a date stamp on the judgment, so we don't know exactly what time it happened. But he did interlineate in the judgment, no objection was received, which is evidence that he never saw the supplemental reply, never had a chance to consider the argument made by the appellants about the reasonableness.
Is this an argument that was made on appeal? A challenge to the reasonableness? Is there an assignment of error on this?
Yes, I believe there is. I believe that several tens, if not 20 pages, were devoted to the reasonableness of the fees and the costs. So it's our position that that was waived. Even if the trial court did see that supplemental reply before he entered, before the judge entered the judgment, he was entirely authorized to disregard it. It was unauthorized. It was untimely. And he could just set it aside. That is not an abuse of discretion if he were to choose to do that. But we think he never even saw it. So in closing, Your Honors, we would ask that the court affirm the trial court's entry of summary judgment, affirm the entry of the supplemental judgment that awarded reasonable fees and costs, and finally to award TBF its fees and other legal expenses incurred on appeal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Who are you seeking fees from on appeal?
I'm sorry?
Who are you seeking fees from on appeal?
Well, we are seeking fees primarily from Mr. Petrenko, who's liable on both leases. Mr. Bogoliubov, he has settled.
He has no liability on the second lease, and he settled your claims on the first lease. What would be the theory of his liability on appeal?
It is pretty tenuous, Your Honor. The only theory that we could go against him is really that his guarantee was a continuing guarantee for all future liabilities. But that's the law of the case is probably that that was not. It's basically not how the trial court ruled. So we would basically relinquish the request for fees and costs against Mr. Bogoliubov and just ask for them strictly from Mr. Petrenko.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. In regards to attorney fees, Your Honor, we actually did file the joint opposition request to strike the untimely plaintiff motion to amend judgment, and it's Court Papers 147. And because under civil
in that document, did you challenge the reasonableness of the fees?
No, we didn't challenge the reasonableness. We challenged the timeliness because under rule
timeliness of the request.
Correct. Yeah, correct.
But you didn't in that document tell the judge that you had any objection to the amount that was being requested.
Correct. No, we didn't. But then plaintiff did reply, and we did satisfy King County Local Civil Rule 7B4E, and in that we did, counsel was right, we did file it before noon on that day.
Wasn't it due noon the day before?
But, I mean, pursuant to that rule, it's due on the noon on the day off. Or the day before. We did it pursuant to this rule.
Okay, well, his argument is that the rule required you to get it there by noon the day before the hearing and that you got it there sometime shortly after 10 the day of the hearing. Do you disagree with what the rule requires as represented by opposing counsel?
No, I actually agree with the rule, and we did it pursuant to the rule. Okay. And, Your Honor, I also wanted to tell you that we did file a motion to reconsider. Even judge, if he didn't see it, maybe he could reconsider, but it was also denied. After that, Mr. Bogoliubov filed a motion to reconsider. And I just wanted to talk about reasonableness of fees. They rose from $1,500 to $12,000 in 2 months. Before summary judgment, plaintiff asked only for $1,500, and then there was no deposition or discovery. And reasonableness, we questioned the reasonableness for the fee. And I was prepared to argue that fees for the second lease should not be assessed against Mr. Bogoliubov, but
you've got a concession on that point.
Yes, I got a concession, so I'm not going to argue. In short, Your Honor, we would like to ask this court to dismiss the action because it was not properly sued, properly filed. The plaintiff had no capacity to sue, and reverse the trial court's dismissal of our counterclaims and partial summary judgment. And we request that plaintiff's attorney fees for this appellate are also denied. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Court will now be in recess.
All rise.